You're listening to KVMR FM Nevada City. Next up is the Homestead Radio Hour. For their support, we'd like to thank Sierra Nevada Memorial Hospital, committed to providing fully digital diagnostic imaging services, including a 64-slice CT scanner, plus MRI, mammography, ultrasound, and nuclear medicine. More information, snmh.org, Sierra Nevada Memorial Hospital. Sometimes a closer look is all it takes.
And this is episode 2 of the Homestead Radio Hour here on KVMR.
With your hosts, Phyllis and Julia.
We're pleased, as always, to be here with you. And today we'll be talking about beekeeping. We'll be taking a look at the hows, the whys, and the rewards of having your own hive and, of course, your own honey.
And how you can do it, too, in your own backyard. First, we're going to start, though, with a regular feature called Garden Club, in which we tell you what we're doing at home and what you should be doing now. Julia, what have we been doing on the farm?
Well, it's springtime. It is glorious out there, absolutely gorgeous weather, as I'm sure you all have observed. So, really, in my opinion, this is the time to be doing anything outdoors, anything whatsoever, just soaking up that sunshine. But in particular, planning for your summer garden, cleaning up your garden space, and getting everything ready to go as soon as the weather is warm enough to plant.
It's too early to plant now, of course, but you can sure be looking at those catalogs and visiting the nursery and thinking about what you want to plant, laying out your garden, and doing what I've been doing for the past 2 days, drag and brush, because you really need to get things cleaned up. And speaking of dragging brush, there has been a lot of down limbs. I was just listening to an article yesterday about how fire season this year is going to be troublesome because there's so much dragged brush, so many down limbs, that need to be cleaned up. You need to be doing that now.
That's right. Get everything ready for fire season and neatening up your yard as well. And I know in Placer County we have a program that offers free chipping services if you don't want to burn brush, which is really a more environmentally friendly and easier way to handle all that stuff.
Plus, you will get plenty of mulch out of it. If you have to burn, you need a permit. If you can get by with chipping, it's a better idea. So call your fire department. They will have the information on whether you have a chipping program. And if you don't, they will issue you the fire permit.
And now also is the time to start looking through those seed catalogs, as I was doing yesterday. If you're planning to order anything, you do need to get on that right now so you'll have the seeds for as soon as it's warm enough to plant. You can find all kinds of unusual varieties, heirloom varieties, or even just check your local nursery and see what they have in stock. But if you're planning to be planting tomatoes and peppers from seeds, those really need to be going right now. You could start winter squash if you'd like to grow banana squash or Hubbards or butternuts, anything like that this summer. It really does pay off to get them a little extra start. So if you have a sunny windowsill, a greenhouse, perhaps a cold frame, where you can get those seeds a start in some little six-packs, that's a great idea to be working on right now.
And you can also be putting in cover crops. That's something we're doing at home, is putting in cover crops between our rows of trees to give the soil a little extra nutrition. And you can find good seed mixes at farm supplies and garden stores that will have things like fava beans and clover, things that will enrich your soil.
Mm-hmm, nitrogen-fixing plants. And some plants have properties that will help target specific problems. If you have heavy clay soils, you can get particular types that have deep roots that will break that up if you need extra nitrogen. So that's a good one to go talk to your local nursery or farm supply and see what they recommend, because they can help you pick out something that will really improve your soil specifically for the problems that it has. And if you have a cover crop already growing, as soon as the soil dries out a bit, it'll be time to till it in to get your summer garden beds ready to go, maybe throw a little manure out there.
And that soil amendment is important around here because, as you all know, we've got pretty to look at red clay, but it sure doesn't plant very well unless you do take care of it.
That's right. So this wonderful weather is just putting us all in a garden state of mind. We've been harvesting wonderful salad greens from our little lettuce plot.
Mm, yeah, that's been nice.
And it's still not too late to plant lettuce, radishes, carrots, all those kinds of things. So all good stuff to be thinking about this time of year. But on to the topic at hand today, beekeeping. You may have considered having a hive in your garden, but bees, because of their stinging nature, they have a bit of a bad reputation in that regard. They're extremely gentle once you get to know them, and there are a bevy of reasons to have a beehive in your own backyard.
Which we'll be talking about.
You betcha. We'll be back in just a moment.
Oh, what a glorious thing to be, a healthy grown-up, busy, busy bee, filing away the passing hours, pinching all the pollen from the cauliflowers. I'd like to be a busy, busy bee, being just as busy as a bee can be, flying round the garden, the sweetest ever seen, taking back the honey to the dear old queen. Buzz, 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 honey bee, buzz, if you like, but don't sting me. Buzz, 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 honey bee, buzz, if you like, but don't sting me. Honey bee, I must buzz off. Buzz if you like, but don't sting me.
So why keep bees? Why bring 40,000 little bugs into your backyard? Well, there are a few very good reasons. First of all, it's a fascinating hobby and a great family activity. If you're careful around the bees and you have proper bee-suiting equipment, there's really pretty little risk of getting stung, especially for people who are observing, such as kids. It's a really great way to get a closer look at the big picture of how a garden works. And pollination is another excellent reason to have your own hive. We have a couple of pomegranate trees, and we never really had much in the pomegranate department until we started keeping bees. The first year, before that, we always would maybe get one or two if we were lucky. The first year we had a beehive, we must have had 20 pomegranates on this little bush, which was really a spectacular turnabout and a very immediate gratification for the effort of having bees.
I think we've noticed all of our crops have improved since we've had the bees. They flower much better, even earlier.
It's squash, really cucumbers. If you have any kind of problems with your garden setting fruit, a beehive is a great way to remedy that.
And the nice bonus from the bees, of course, is the honey.
Mm-hmm.
I was never a honey eater until we got our own bees, because store-bought honey, it's bland compared to what you will get out of your hives, partly because it's older. It's just a product of age, maybe, but when you taste honey straight out of your hive, you'll be a convert, as I was.
And it also tastes like, when you talk about wines, you speak about terroir. It's the same idea. It tastes like the place it's coming
right
from, the flowers in your area. We have a lot of blackberry around here, which makes excellent honey. And it's just really a fun little addition to your homestead, as well as being a local source of sweetener. I've been hearing quite a bit lately about how sugar beets are targeted for genetic modification, and that's raising some concerns. With honey, you don't have to worry about that. You know exactly what you're putting in your hive.
And also, honey is slightly more nutritious than sugar. I mean, you know, sweet is sweet, but it does have a variety of nutrients in it, small amounts, but they're there, antioxidants. And it also has a lower glycemic index than sugar, which means that your body metabolizes it more slowly and you don't get the sugar rush that you do from eating sucrose, which is white sugar.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't cause that immediate spike and sudden drop in your blood sugar quite the same way. And it's delicious.
Yes, it's very delicious.
You can bake with it, you can cook with it. All kinds of uses for honey you'll discover as soon as you find 50 pounds of it sitting in your backyard.
And you eat it right off your fingers when you're extracting it. It's so wonderful.
It is. So beekeeping is good for the earth. It's good for you. We've all been hearing about the problems bees are facing lately, and we'll be discussing that later with our guests, Janet Brisson and Randy Oliver, in a little more detail.
Local experts.
But having your own beehive can work wonders for both your farm, and it helps out the bee population as well.
And the relationship between humans and bees goes back thousands of years. In prehistoric times, people took honey from the hives of wild bees in hollow trees. And about 4,000 years ago, the Egyptians kept bees in sort of cigar-shaped hives that they made of clay. And during the Middle Ages, beekeepers used the dome-shaped hives called skeps, which you probably know what we're talking about there.
The classic beehive, kind of an upside-down basket, usually.
Right. When you see a picture of a beehive, it's usually a skep.
So the problem with all these methods of beekeeping were that you really had to destroy the entire hive to get the honey out, which is not good for your relationship with the bees, exactly. They're not going to be happy with that. And it's also destructive to the whole colony. They have to start from scratch. So the modern beehive, pioneered by a fellow named Langstroth, usually known as the Langstroth Hive, consists of a wooden box, several stacking wooden boxes with parallel frames of comb inside, which make it easy for the beekeeper to lift out the frames, both to inspect the colony and to extract the honey as well, and then those combs can be emptied and put right back in for the bees to use again.
Bees right for you? It's the first thing you have to think about when you're going to consider getting bees. You need to first invest some time in research on beekeeping. This is not something where, I feel like planting tomatoes today, I go to the nursery and buy some seeds and plant them. You need to think about whether bees are right for you, whether you're right for bees.
They're a little more complicated than tomatoes, that's for sure. But if you have some contacts with beekeepers, join a local organization. That is really the best way to get into beekeeping because you will learn so much. And that's the thing that it really amazes me about bees is that you never, ever stop learning. Every year, every season, there's something new that you learn or you see while you're out there working with a hive.
The best way to do this, as Julie mentioned, is to find out if you have a local beekeeping organization. There's a wonderful one here in Nevada County. There's one in Sacramento County. And in between, I'm not sure how many more there are, but we know that the Truckee area is trying to think of beginning to think of setting one up. But it's an invaluable resource because you can go to the meetings. You'll always be able to talk to other beekeepers. You will hear interesting lectures about bees. You will have opportunities to do hands-on if you can hook up with a beekeeper, which is very easy because beekeepers are always willing to share their craft, aren't they?
And a helper is always a good thing to have around. So if you're willing to get out there and help, you will surely find someone who would love to have you in his or her bee yard. If you're calling in, we'll be taking calls in the later part of the program, and we'd be happy to hear from you then. A few more things to consider if you're planning to get bees. Location is really number one on the list. If you live in a residential area, you'll need to make sure that your neighbors aren't going to be upset by your beehive. Bees aren't really, they're not a nuisance, and they're not going to go out of their way to sting anyone. But if there are children around, you know, you might want to make sure that the bees are in an out-of-the-way area where they won't be an
issue.
Well,
people are fearful of bees. Mm-hmm. You know, there's still that notion that they are going to sting you, but you really have to irritate them in order for them to sting you. And that's something
true.
You can talk to your neighbors about. It's probably best not to just set up a hive next to your neighbor's fence without asking
mm-hmm.
them about
or
it.
Or next to a sidewalk or any right. trafficked area. And a jar of honey does go a long
does
way to
long way,
convincing
right.
people that bees are a good addition to the neighborhood. And legal issues as well. You might want to call your city or county office and make sure that it's okay to have a beehive, but it generally is in our
area. We know, and we don't know the ordinances in Nevada County or Placer County, really, but in Sacramento County, we know that you can have two beehives in a city residence, which is pretty lenient, I think. So.
And outside of the city, I think there aren't really much in the restriction department.
I think it's an area that hasn't been looked into yet, so we're not even sure that there are any regulations
mm-hmm.
in Auburn. We've never been able to find out if there are or not. So.
But nobody seems to mind, and if your bees are well-behaved and you don't make them a nuisance, then it should be no problem at all. Allergies are another thing to consider, of course. If anyone is allergic to bee stings, you'll need to take the proper precautions, have an EpiPen on hand, or somehow address that.
You also want to consider, what do they say, the two things you think about are your back and the sting. The sting and the back. You do have to do some heavy lifting with beekeeping, and if you don't have a good back or maybe you're older, you will probably want to partner up with somebody, which is a good idea anyway because it's much more fun to do these things with a partner.
It really is, and having an extra pair of hands and eyes is really indispensable when you're out there with the bees. Also a great thing to do with a neighbor or family member if there's anybody else in the area that might be interested in going into beekeeping with you. By all means, do search around for someone to go into it with you at the same time.
You also will have an initial cash outlay, of course, and it can be very low to very high, depending on what kind of beekeeping you want to do. You can make your own equipment, which bee boxes are generally pretty simple. I know we've made a lot of our own.
You can get the pieces and nail them and paint them yourself.
Or you can buy it ready-made, ready to go. You can spend anywhere. I think we have seen starting bee kits in a catalog for around $125, $30. Or they have a deluxe kit for around $500, you know. So.
And if you join a beekeeping organization or make friends with some beekeepers, you may find someone who is selling awesome old equipment or could even loan you something to get started with, which is a great way to ease into it.
That's true. We recently heard of an older beekeeper who was giving up his bees, and he was selling everything. He had quite a collection of equipment, selling everything for very low prices. So that's, as she said, another reason to become a member of a beekeeping association. You might wonder if you have the time for beekeeping. It doesn't take a big outlay of time. There are certain times of year that you have to do certain jobs, but most of the time the bees take care of themselves. It's not like you, like a dog or something, where you can't go away
you
for a week or two and leave it. You don't have to walk the bees.
It's probably an hour or two a month, just checking in on them during the busy season. During much of the year, though, they'll really be taking care of themselves. So it depends on your situation, the resilience of your bees, and really how involved you want to be as well. You may find yourself putting on your bee veil and going out there just to peek in that box because you're curious as to what the bees are up to today.
And it is fascinating. It's such a little ecosystem in there that's just amazing. When you start learning about bees and learning what they do inside that dark hive, you won't believe it.
So how do you get bees? Where do they come from? The easiest way, again, is probably to join a beekeeping club or make friends with some beekeepers, and you'll meet someone who is selling bees either as a whole hive, or more often in the spring they're sold as what are called nucs, nucleus colonies, which are a few frames of brood and a queen, which will then establish the larger hive. So that's a good way to get a hold of some bees. You can also mail order them.
Which is not, in our minds, a really good idea. It's really better to get your bees locally, because you know that you'll know their source, you know that they've done well in the past if you're buying them from someone local. Mail
and there's
order
someone
bees,
you can go back to.
Right. If you have to mail order, you have to. But in this area, you don't have to. You can always find another source.
So yet another reason to join a beekeeping organization. And the Nevada County Beekeeping Association is really an excellent group. We'll be talking about that a little bit more later. You can find endless resources and people to help you out there.
And this is the time, speaking of getting your bees, this is the time to be setting up a new hive. In the springtime is when you want to get it started. So
once you have the bees, how much maintenance is going into them? Well, it really does change seasonally, as we talked about. The equipment-wise, in addition to the hive, you'll need a few tools. It's not really anything terribly complicated. A bee suit, which you typically see the beekeepers in the white
suits,
coveralls.
White coveralls from the auto parts store work beautifully.
Pick those up for pretty cheap. I always wear a pair of tall black rain boots with the coveralls tucked into them because you don't want the bees climbing up your legs, but work boots or anything like that where you can tuck in the cuffs are a good idea.
And you will need a bee veil. This is critical. You absolutely must have a veil to keep the bees away from your face, because when bees get irritated, they will go for your face. That's the first thing they're going to do, is bump you and let you know that they want you out of there. And bee stings around the face and head are not good.
They know how to find your eyes.
So that's probably your costliest piece, and that only runs, what, $20 maybe?
And it'll last you for years and years.
Your main tool, your most important tool, is the little thing called the hive tool, and it can range from $1 to $5, so that's the kind of equipment you're looking at for
beekeeping. Yeah, pretty straightforward. And while we're talking about bee veils and stings and whatnot, not to be frightened by that, because the bees usually will warn you. They'll start bumping into you or buzzing around in a way that, as you learn to read the bees, you'll be able to understand when it's time to back off. And, of course, the other important piece of equipment is the smoker.
Yes, the smoker is very important. That's what you use to settle the bees when you are opening the hive. You'll puff a little bit of smoke in there, which you've made using the pine needles off of your property.
Copious amounts of pine needles around here. And it's like a little can with a bellows and a snout that will just puff the smoke, cool smoke, right into the hive. And that is believed to trigger the bees' reflex. They think the hive is on fire, so they immediately start filling themselves up with honey and start making their plan to leave and find another place to live and save their colony if they must. So while they're distracted with all these other thoughts, you can just
That's
work around
you get
in
there and work. Let's give a quick seasonal overview of what you might be doing spring, summer, fall, winter. Starting in the spring, of course, we already mentioned you're going to be getting your bees and you're going to be setting up your hive. At that point, you'll probably want to inspect your colony every week or two to make sure everything's okay.
We were just out a couple days ago checking for queens, making sure all the hives are in good working order and ready to gear up for the honey flow.
And if you have to medicate them for any reason, there are a number of diseases that can attack your bees just like any other plant or animal. And there are medications you might be using. If you are going to do that, you're going to be wanting to stop in late spring so that when the honey comes on, there won't be any of whatever you've used in it.
And the medications are offered in organic and otherwise forms, which we'll be discussing a bit later with our guests.
And then as you move into summer...
Summer is honey time. The springtime bloom will cause what is called the honey flow, which is where the bees are out there gathering nectar and pollen and packing it into the hive. As summer comes, somewhere around July or so around here for us, it's honey harvest time. So we pull all those frames of comb out of the hive and put them into an extractor. Now, a mechanical extractor is a nice thing to have and another reason to get involved with the beekeeping club. You can usually rent one.
Right, because our beekeeping club, for example, rents out an extractor, so we don't have to make that purchase. Although the first time, if you are a very small scale beekeeper, say you have one hive, which we had in the very beginning, we used nylon stockings and just strained the honey out through the stockings. We didn't even use an extractor. So, you know, again, it's minimal equipment.
Mm-hmm. That's the easiest way to go. If you have more combs, you'll want to use the extractor, which is really like a big washing machine that spins and the centrifugal force pulls the honey out of the combs, and then it runs out the bottom and you can bottle it.
And this is where the back part comes in. If you need a strong back, because if you're lifting two supers, say, off of a hive, it can weigh around 125 pounds. So you probably are going to want a helper to do this part of the work.
And extracting honey is really fun, to be honest. It's a big group project.
Oh, it is. We have friends come over, and
we have a little honey house
that we do it in, and it's really... It's something you don't want to do in your kitchen, incidentally.
No,
do it outdoors.
Yeah, someplace where the bees won't get to it, but someplace where you aren't too terribly worried about things getting a bit sticky. And bring your friends over and have a honey extracting party and send everyone home with a jar of honey, and they'll all be thrilled.
And after you've done this, you've extracted your honey and put your hives back together, and you're coming into winter, there's not a lot you can do in winter with the bees. You just hope that... they make it through the winter because they weaken, and then sometimes they need to be fed. You might need to feed them with a sugar water solution.
When you're extracting the honey, you want to make sure you leave plenty for the bees in the hive as well, because they'll make more than they can use, and that's why we can harvest it. But if they get a little low on food stores during the winter time, you might feed them a sugar syrup or something like that to keep them happy and content. But really just making sure they're warm and well-fed, they'll be fine through the winter. And
we don't have too much of a problem with winter here. We read about beekeeping in Minnesota, for example. They have to wrap their hives in black plastic to keep enough warmth in there for the bees to survive. Here they do pretty well by themselves. You just have to make sure they have enough to eat. That's all.
So, it's about 12:30 here, and we do have some guests who will be joining us here in the studio presently.
We have with us today Janet Brisson from the Nevada County Beekeeping Association and Randy Oliver.
And we'll be welcoming them into the studio in just a moment. goodness, there's a bit of a buzz there.
Yeah.
just a moment while we try to figure out what's up with that.
Okay, it's gone.
Janet, if you'd like to grab that other microphone there, that would be better. That seems to be where it's coming from. Thank you very much. Okay. Janet Brisson, a local beekeeper, and you've been keeping bees since 1995?
That's right.
Organically as well, yes?
Well, the 1995 to about 2005, we did use Apistan. At that time, you really couldn't keep bees without using some type of a pesticide.
Mm-hmm.
But we started using screen bottom boards, and we were able to reduce our pesticide use in half. 2005, we found the pesticide totally failed. The varroa mites were resistant. And about the time I was ready to look at a more powerful insecticide, I think it was Cumafloss, Randy came to our meeting and said, oh, someone's using powdered sugar to dislodge mites out of whole hives. That was all the information he had. I went right to the store, bought powdered sugar, and the next day applied it to the hives, just used a sifter over the tops of the hives, and what came on the bottom boards were literally thousands of mites. We stopped counting at 1,400. It was just amazing.
Wow.
And so since 2005, for the last 10 years, that's all we've used is powdered sugar and drone brood management, another technique.
Very cool.
And this goes back to what we were talking about when you had to stop using your pesticides in early spring because it would get into the honey. Well, now with the powdered sugar and other organics, you don't have to worry so much about that.
Right.
And the varroa mite is really one of the nastiest pests that we have. We haven't talked about that too much yet on the show, but it's a big problem for the bees in the area. So
and
always good to...
beekeepers.
It's great to have an organic way to handle that.
Right. We also have with us Randy Oliver, who is a local beekeeper who has become a bee researcher, a popular writer for beekeeping journals, and a very well-traveled speaker at conferences. Randy's specialty is in translating scientific research into practical beekeeping methods.
So who better to have here today with us?
All right.
Well, thank you.
And we're lucky to have him in our beekeeping organization.
Mm. Well, I think the number one question that people have as soon as you mention honeybees is, what's happening to
the
bees?
I could probably give you a heads up on that. First thing, that bee problems largely follow the weather. If you have a poor weather conditions where the bees can't forage, they can't get much nutrition. And if they go into the winter without good nutrition, they are very likely to succumb to one kind of stress, another, usually some kind of pathogen stress. When we had the big colony collapse disorder losses back in 2006, they followed the worst drought in the Midwest in a very long time. And so it was not expected that a lot of colonies would be stressed going into winter and coming into spring. And then the bees tended to rebound, and last year the bees did pretty darn well. It was good weather, and the bees did well. This year, it was a long, rainy, cold summer throughout much of the Midwest, where many of the bees come from, in the Dakotas and those areas, and wound up being the worst honey crop in U.S. history. Well, anytime you see the worst honey crop in U.S. history, you could better expect a lot of bees are going to go into bed hungry, that they're going to go into the winter hungry. That just happens. Beekeepers just can't feed them enough to try to make up for that. In addition, another thing happened is that there were early frosts, which killed some of the fall pollen, natural pollen that bees need for protein nutrition. And the third thing was, when the weather finally cleared up in the late summer, many commercial beekeepers, instead of doing a miticide treatment to take care of varroa mite at that time, which would be the proper timing, chose to leave their honey supers on and try to get one little bit of a honey harvest to make some money and let the mites just continue to multiply in the late summer when it's critical not to do that. By the time they got their honey off and were able to deal with the mites, it was too late. What happens if you have viruses go epidemic in the beehive? So it was not at all unexpected there would be massive losses this year, and there were. There were hundreds of thousands of colonies were moved to California and died here in California prior to the almond bloom. Losses of millions of dollars for some of the large beekeepers. Really, really, really a tough situation. So one, yes, you may hear about colony collapse disorder coming back this year, but the thing is, with colony collapse disorder, that's not a winter starvation thing. That's not a mite problem. Those things are pretty well understandable. colony collapse disorder has a distinct set of symptoms, and that is the sudden disappearance of adult bees, leaving behind a healthy-looking brood nest, which is the larvae and pupae in the colony. That is very unusual. Now, the disappearance of bees is not unusual at all. It's very rare for a sick bee to die within the hive. If a bee feels sick, they fly out and they die outside so that they sacrifice their life so they don't spread the disease, whatever is hurting them, to the rest of the bees in the hive. So the bees disappearing is not unusual. What's unusual is for the adult population to disappear wholesale in a very short order, in a matter of days or weeks, leaving behind what was apparently had the signs of being what looked like a healthy colony just shortly beforehand. That's still the large mystery. Now, one thing that I can share is I'm involved right now here in Nevada County. We're doing a FDA-approved trial for an antiviral product, totally natural. It deals with short interfering RNA, which is the hot topic in biology right now, a way that your body fights viruses besides your antibodies, but it's the main way that insects fight viruses. This is fairly recently discovered, and a company out of Miami has developed a product using this natural product that you can feed to the bees in a sugar syrup, and we're testing to see if indeed it will help with these virus problems and possibly with CCD. We run this trial right here in Nevada County. If anybody is really interested, you're welcome to contact me. But let me tell you where it stands right now. We started this trial in the late summer, randomized and equalized 72 colonies, have a control group and then two treatment groups. Then after they had the colonies were well-established and doing well, we inoculated all of them with a virus cocktail, purified virus cocktail that we got from a commercial beekeeper, the samples from a commercial beekeeper who suffered from CCD the previous year. We inoculated all the colonies with the virus cocktail in sugar syrup, and in about 9 days, they just started collapsing. It was really, really impressive. And the collapses continued through the winter. I had some visitors from Australia here the last 2 days, and they were very curious about CCD, so I took them out at the yard. And we could go into those colonies, and we could see colonies in every stage of the collapse. They took lots of photographs, but I've been marking them, so I could walk to a colony and say, here's a colony that is healthy, here's one that is on the going downhill, here's one that is at the end where you have the little handful of bees left, the queen valiantly laying, just trying to keep the colony alive, because it doesn't hurt the queens, they stay healthy. This little tiny handful patch full of eggs and the bees trying, but all you have left is just young bees and the queen. Their colony's going to die. Clear to seeing colonies had no bees left, but you could still see eggs, fresh eggs in there that the queen had been laying up to the last minute before the last bees died. So it was pretty sad.
So you're replicating colony collapse disorder.
Well, I'm being very cautious about this. Mm-hmm. We're replicating the symptoms, okay? So we can create similar types of collapses. Now, mm-hmm. Personally, my opinion is that's likely the major cause of colony collapse would be I left out one of their players. There's also an intestinal parasite that bees picked up sometime fairly recently, in the last couple of decades, it looks like, called Nosema serrani. And it looks like that may well be a co-player in these collapses. We chose these colonies intentionally that had Nosema serrani and randomized that. So at this point, I can't tell you whether it's the viruses alone or the interaction between Nosema serrani mm-hmm. and the viruses. But I can rule out a whole bunch of things. These colonies have been in Nevada County on an organic farm for 3 years now, so there were no pesticides. We had to put no synthetic miticides in these colonies. We had the varroa mite levels very low, and they all had young queen bees, were well-fed, and had good nutrition. So we can rule out all those common factors. Now, I did use my cell phone in the yard.
Oh, that's what people think about all the time.
Yeah. But I had been using it for a long time with no ill effects on the bees.
So this all sounds really scary. What does it mean for a small-scale home beekeeper? Do we need to worry about...
In terms of... Yes, go ahead. But it reminds me of something that someone asked at the meeting the other night. It was of the first class that Randy teaches of the Beekeepers Association. And someone listened to this about Nosema and about colony collapse. And they said, well, why should I keep bees if they're all going to die? So how can you address that? What would you say?
That's a very good question. And it has been trying for a lot of people. I had troubles myself in my operation the last 2 years. This year, knock on wood, my bees are doing very well, although I just took a sample moments before I came to the studio here, And we do have Nosema sereni level climbing, so that's something I may have to address. And then luckily, there are some natural treatments. There's an oak bark extract. That you can use in there. So, but to answer your question is, you know, there's times when it's kind of discouraging to teach a beginner's class saying, hey, you know, you're going to have problems. We a lot of the hobbyists did have problems this year. But I can say that we're learning a lot. Number one I'm finding is nutrition is everything. And we live in an unusual beekeeping environment in that, if you haven't noticed, it doesn't rain all summer here. Anywhere east of the Rockies, that's unheard of. I mean, it rains all during the summer everywhere else. And there's stuff for the bees to eat all throughout the summer and fall, often large pollen flows and nectar flows in the fall. So the bees get lots of natural food prior to the winter. California, that doesn't happen. We can go 6 months without any rain. So essentially here in the foothills, if you're away from an area where there's irrigation, your bees are pretty much starving from July 1st until going into winter. It's really rough on them. What we've found is feeding them a nutritional supplement, a protein supplement to mimic pollen, and it's made out of just healthful food. We use brewer's yeast, food-grade dried egg yolk, some soy protein, some vitamins, essential oils. We make up an artificial protein diet, but it's very, very natural, healthy food. And by simply giving the bees some of that, it just changes everything. They don't have anywhere near the health problems that they have. Would have otherwise. So that's a huge management issue. And in answer to the hobbyists who have lost their colonies, all I can say is, you know, we've adopted certain practices, and I consider them pretty much natural practices, that our colonies are thriving and staying alive. So if they stay on it, keep an eye on the parasites in the hives, monitor those, and give them decent nutrition, I think you can very successfully keep bees alive right now.
One thing about hobbyist beekeepers, they tend to coddle their hives. They watch them a lot more. And like us, we keep our bees on irrigated, I mean, we have an organic farm, so we have produce and trees, and there's always something in bloom. And so, but if you have a lot of hives and they deplete their nutrition, then there is artificial foods and sugar syrups that you can fall back on.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you will have disappointments. And when we first started, we lost a hive or two, and you just pick up and start over again, you know. Mm-hmm. You keep going, and then you become
every
successful.
Spring is a new year.
That's right.
So, Janet, I know your bees are part of a homestead situation. You're a self-sufficient family. How does that figure into what you do as a whole?
Well, that's how we entered beekeeping. We had an organic farm. We had a orchard with 100 trees, and we had a commercial beekeeper within 2 miles of us. In 1995, all of his bees died due to the first wave of varroa mites, and for the first year, I tried hand pollination. That didn't work. Nothing pollinates effectively like a bee does, and that forced me into a beekeeping class. And I have to admit, I was a wimp. I didn't want to take the class. I put it off as long as possible. But I have to say, taking that beekeeping class, and Randy was our instructor, was the most life-changing situation for us. Because of that, well, the farm came back, and everything bloomed. We had huge watermelon, huge zucchini. But the most important thing is we were looking for ways to reduce the pesticide usage, and we came up with a piece of beekeeping equipment, varroa mites, easy to use powdered sugar and other types of pesticides that were on the market, and it took off unexpectedly because of all the problems with the honeybees. A lot more people felt like they needed to help, and our piece of equipment was basically designed for the hobbyist beekeeper. So for the last 5 years, we've been selling this piece of equipment all across the United States and Canada. We were picked up by a major beekeeping catalog, and it has kept us so busy, we almost had to put the farm on hold while we figured out how to manufacture this piece of equipment and keep up with demand. So it was very life-changing for us. I'm still a wimp. When I take care of our bees, I wear a full suit with gloves, but I love it.
And that's not being a wimp. It's just being cautious.
Yeah, just being out there qualifies you as not a wimp.
Yeah, and the beekeeping class, as Janet said, is absolutely fabulous. We liked it so much we took it twice.
I did too, right.
Well worth it.
It is definitely.
So for listeners who would like to investigate organic beekeeping, is that any more difficult than conventional chemical?
I would have to say it's a lot more time, and it's very intensive. You spend a lot more time observing your bees, applying the powdered sugar. It's not like the chemical pesticides that they have on the market where you use it once in the spring and once in the fall. It's I do it all year, sometimes three times a month if our mite loads get high. When they're low, like right now, we came into the spring with virtually no mites. We have six hives, and I just powdered them yesterday. Randy came up with this technique called an amplified sticky, where you can dust your bees and then look at the powdered sugar that drops through and see what your mite load is. And so it will go up as we go through the year. By the time fall comes, we'll be dusting our bees like once a week, you know, in 3-week periods. Mm-hmm. It is more intensive, but well worth it, because you know you have nothing in your hive.
Right.
That's, you know, yeah, pesticides.
Pure clean honey. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, well, we have someone calling in right now. And caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hello. I'm intrigued to hear so much about the mites. I thought that they might be one of the parts of the collapse problem. Here in my yard, when I moved in here 8 years ago, I had a colony in an old oak tree, and then a few years later, another colony established itself in some landscape timbers. And then we had that huge rain, I think it was like 2005 or 2006, long rain in the springtime, that old oak tree collapsed. I think it crushed that colony, but at the same time, the other colony from the landscape timbers had left. And is there another consideration besides the mites that one might consider prior to establishing a colony? I've heard reported recently that wherever a cell phone tower is erected, all of the local colonies collapse.
And that's not true. You can keep bees under a cell phone tower easily.
Oh, great. because one had coincidentally come up in the same area, and I wanted that.
Yeah, you're gonna. There are some, I guess I call them urban legends, that keep getting repeated about out there, and a number of them that are being blamed for colony collapse just have no supportive data at all. The whole cell phone thing was from a piece of research in Germany that wasn't even about cell phones. It was about a home mobile phone transmitters, and the researchers retracted the study entirely because there were problems. But the cell phones have never, there's never anything really linking cell phones.
But it sounds like a good story.
Right.
Thanks for your call. We have another caller. And you're live on KVMR.
Yeah, hi there. I'm wondering, why is it that the bees are, I mean, bees naturally would be sort of eating their own honey, so why are they being fed sugar instead of just their own honey?
There's many years where the bees don't make enough honey to survive. They would die. So it's just like, you know, if you have livestock on a pasture, and there's a drought and there's no food for them, you'll bring them in food. Well, to a bee, sugar is food. Just like to a hummingbird, sugar is food. It's a common misconception that honey is necessarily a better food than sugar syrup would be. There's a number of honeys that are actually toxic to the bees. They actually have a problem with them. And we have one right here locally, the buckeye, that's toxic. So bees do very well on sugar syrup. That's another misconception that people try to extrapolate from being a human, where I would not recommend you feed your children a straight diet of sugar syrup. What you got to realize is...
But feed them honey,
yeah,
right?
The nutrition to bees does not come from the honey at all. There's very little bee nutrition in honey. Now, honey is very good for people for other reasons, but not as a nutritional source. The nutrition to bees, all the proteins, the vitamins and minerals, all the lipids, the sterols, all come from the pollen they gather. So simply giving them as the energy source, they just use the sugar syrup or the honey as an energy source to create heat within the colony so they can stay warm.
But I'm just, what I'm suggesting is that if you could just, if they could have their own honey that they made.
They can have their own honey. That's what I'm totally in agreement with you. I winter my bees on their own honey. I don't feed sugar syrup for them.
Okay.
Yeah. But there are times when there is no honey. They don't have their own honey. If there's a drought, they don't make honey, and they will starve to death over the winter.
Well, of course. I'm just saying, you know, sort of in an ideal situation, if there was enough and everything, you would think that they would be, you know, happiest with what they made themselves.
Not necessarily at all. I just got back from speaking in Manitoba, Canada, where the main honey crop is from canola. That's huge across Canada. Canola honey granulates rock hard very quickly in the combs. In terms of it looks like a white rock in there. Because of the low humidity in Canada, if you give winter their bees with a hive full of canola honey, they'll starve to death. They simply cannot survive on it. You actually, the bees benefit to pull every bit of that canola honey off and extract itself for honey and then feed them back sugar syrup, and they winter very well on that. So in that case, actually, the natural honey would be the worst food for them, and the sugar syrup would be the best.
Yeah, well, that's also sort of like a big agribusiness sort of situation, too.
Not necessarily. Many of these guys aren't around agribusiness. It just happens that the mustard or canola, and it could just be a mustard field. It would be the same thing. There's a number of honeys in many areas that are not good bee forage. In the East Coast, the goldenrod, bees will often die if they try to winter on goldenrod honey. There's too many minerals in it, and the bees get dysentery during the winter.
And bees are not indigenous to this area. They're actually European honeybees. They were brought over. And so, especially out here in California, it's totally different climates than what they're used to. So, as Randy said before, there's times where there's no honey flow. There's no rain to produce the nectar. So we do what we can. A lot of us aren't hobbyist beekeepers, really don't take their bees anywhere. They keep them at home. As opposed to the commercial beekeepers, you take them to almonds where there's monocrops. And so you do have to, it's like monocropping. It's like Randy said, feeding your children one type of food. And it's important to give them a diversity, just like you do your own kids.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. We have a few more callers on the line. And the number here in the studio is 265-9555.
Or 1-800-355-5867 if you have a question for Randy or Janet.
And we do have quite a few people, so please keep your questions
brief,
quick.
Yeah.
Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the great show. I was just wondering if any of you saw the PBS special on the disappearing bees.
Oh, yes.
I can't remember which one it is. I've seen a lot of specials, so I can't remember which one. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, this one, they made it sound like the world was ending. they even showed, you know, orchardists over in China having to do everything by hand.
Oh, yes, I like to show that to all my farmers who pay for pollination.
Right, right. Where they hand-pollinated all those Asian pears.
Gosh.
I'll tell you, hand-pollinating a farm is not an easy thing to do.
Well, I mean, it made it look like the world was ending, and that's where everything's going to go. There's going to be no more bees. I just wonder if you saw it and you wanted to comment on it.
It was a rather extreme view. Here's the deal. Here in the U.S., if there's a shortage of bees, the growers pay more for rent, and it's supply and demand market. You start paying more, suddenly the beekeepers figure out how to keep their bees alive.
So as far as you know, China hasn't lost the majority of their bees over there then?
China's lost a tremendous amount. They have a hard time. They way overuse pesticides. I just had a friend go over and visit there to film that very thing again after seeing that. And, yeah, there's massive pesticide abuse over there. And, they've wiped out not only the bees but other native pollinators, too. So, yes, it is a problem over there.
Great. But, thank you.
Okay.
And, Kali, you're live on KVMR.
Yes, hi. How are you?
You're pretty good. How are you?
We're good. I had a question.
Yes, go ahead.
I live in the valley, and I wanted to start a hive, but there's the Argentine ants that here that are pretty hard to limit their movements, you know.
You want to take it?
Okay, yes, Argentine ants, the little black ants. Actually,
yeah.
Yes, there's things you can do to control them, like a combination of boric acid and sugar. But we're finding that these little ants are actually removing varroa mites that fall below the beehives, and they take them as a protein source. So they're not really all bad. If you have a nice, strong, healthy hive, the bees will keep the ants at bay. And
even the Argentine ants, because they're pretty relentless.
Yeah, here's what we're finding in California. There are a few areas where Argentina ants will actually overpower a colony. It's not most areas they won't do that, but I have heard of a few areas. And as Janet says, there are some pretty natural type of ant baits that can help control them. Otherwise, what you do is you put your hives on stands with little pans of oil around the bottom of the stands and a cover to keep the rain off of that. That'll completely stop the ants from getting in there.
Okay. All right, not water or anything like that, like water, like
it should be an oil, and then have a cover to keep rainwater from falling in there.
Like a vegetable oil?
Fish oil, mineral oil, motor oil, any kind of oil. And the skin of insects is lipophilic, which means the moment an insect touches a pure oil, it just sucks it in and drowns it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, well, I have a hive already, but I need bees. So.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
Hi, caller. You're live on the air at KVMR.
Hi. Hey, I just wanted to point out that one of the theories about why the bees collapsing, too, is because a lot of the California landscape is being taken over by non-native Mediterranean grasses, and we don't have flowers in our landscape anymore, really. We're destroying them with brush clearing. We're weed whipping a lot of our native wildflowers out of existence because we cut them off before they can flower and seed. And there's evidence that bees are collapsing because of changes in the ecological landscape. So I just want to point that out. That is a very serious problem. And I just went to a lot at the corner of McKnight and Freeman there behind Pacific Gas and Electric, and there used to be a huge colony of Humboldt lilies there, beautiful lilies that would flower every summer, and they're completely gone. They brush cleared that lot, and they are totally, utterly gone. And what's there now is Scotch broom. So we have to remember that there's also very serious changes in the California landscape towards non-native grasses and Scotch broom and other weeds, and that's definitely affecting bee populations statewide.
This is happening nationwide and worldwide. And first thing, Scotch broom is actually pretty good bee forage. and many of the Mediterranean and European weeds are actually the plants that the honeybee evolved with. So in many areas, the bees benefit greatly from invasive native, what we call weeds. They're actually, the bees consider them excellent food. But your point is well taken, both with climate change and especially what we call nowadays clean farming, especially with the Roundup Ready crops, where it used to be that farmers would have hedgerows and places for plenty of wildflowers on their farms. Nowadays, they pretty much farm border to border and often eliminate all the weeds that normally would be good bee forage. So forage, you're absolutely right, is a huge issue.
Okay, thank you so much,
you.
Randy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we're just about at the top of the hour here, and we wish we could take some more of your calls, but we're running out of time. So if you'd like to contact us here at the Homestead Radio Hour, you can email us at HRH, that's H as in Homestead, R as in Radio, H as in Hour, at kvmr.org. or homesteadradio@gmail.com and send us your questions and we'll see if we can get you some answers as well. We'd also love to hear your beekeeping related stories or chicken keeping or any of the other topics we discussed. And
we'd like to thank very, very much Janet Brisson and Randy Oliver for coming in today. We could talk to you for a lot longer. I wish we had a couple more hours to go.
Here.
But thanks so much for coming in.
You bet.
It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
And if people are interested in the Nevada County Beekeepers Association, you have a website?
It's ncbees.org, www.ncbees.org. That will take you right to the Nevada County Beekeepers Association page. Our meetings are the first Monday of the month, and from 7 to 9, the meetings are free. We always have a great program and a lot of information. You're very welcome to come.
Yes, and as we said, if you're thinking about bees, go. It's wonderfully helpful to go to these meetings.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful resource. We have a library and beekeepers you can talk to.
Videos.
Really something not to be missed. We'll have all of this as well on our KVMR program page at kvmr.org. If you click on the program schedule tab, scroll down on Fridays to 12 noon and the Homestead Radio Hour, you can find links to the Nevada County Beekeepers and some other resources that may interest you if you're considering getting bees.
And you can also listen to a podcast of the program if you want to hear it again. So.
You bet. And we're on Facebook. Just search for the Homestead Radio Hour there.
So. You can find the Homestead Radio Hour everywhere.
Anywhere you like, whichever way you like. Well, thanks for coming in today, and thank you all for your calls. And we'll be back next month
with another great program, we hope, something that will help you become a backyard gardener, a backyard beekeeper, a backyard chicken keeper.
You can do it all right in your own backyard.
You can.
Okay, Patty Bess is up next with What's Cooking. Stay tuned to KVMR FM Nevada City.